This podcast is a production of KCRW and KCRW.com Santa Monica. If you enjoy this program, check out KCRW.com for more than 20 additional programs that you can podcast.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, but prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, what happens when a studio executive comes out from behind his desk to direct a major motion picture? We'll talk to Kent Alterman, formerly New Line Cinema's executive VP of production and now the director of Semi-Pro. Plus, we say goodbye to HD-DVD. But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Go nowhere, it's The Business from NPR. Will there be an actor's strike? God, we hope not. But the posturing of the leadership of the Screen Actors Guild is not heartening. Instead of sitting down to the negotiating table, as some big-name stars have suggested, the Guild has been busy offering interim agreements with indie production companies so they can finish their films in the event of a strike. There seems to be a de facto strike anyway. Due to the possibility of a walkout, everybody's holding back on making any film they can't finish by the time the contract is up on June 30th. Meanwhile, you've read the book, now see the movie, is a familiar refrain in Hollywood marketing. But the way things are going, you might just want to grab some milk duds and listen to an audiobook instead. According to a new study by the Motion Picture Association of America released last week, the average cost of producing and marketing a studio picture leapt 6.3% to almost $107 million last year. Who paid for that? Unfortunately, you did. Mostly. While revenue from studio movies went up last year, admission stayed the same. Meaning, yes, that's right, you paid 5% more for your movie tickets. Were these movies 5% better? You tell me. Think staying home is the answer? Guess again. CNBC noted last week that DVD rental costs were also up 5.7% this January compared with the same time last year. It seems no matter how you slice it, spending your so-called free time is getting pretty expensive. Elsewhere, in music news, Lou Pearlman, the creator of the Backstreet Boys and NSYNC, pled guilty last week to charges he laundered money and made false statements during a bankruptcy proceeding. Federal prosecutors accused Pearlman of lying to investors to raise financing for bogus ventures, bilking them out of more than $300 million. Astonishingly, federal prosecutors said they still have no plans to charge Pearlman with creating Backstreet Boys and NSYNC. And finally, we're sad to report that E. Gary Gygax, co-creator of the first role-playing game Dungeons & Dragons, died last week at the age of 69. Gygax, who developed the game in 1974 with Dave Arneson, had been suffering from health problems for several years, including low hit points and an armor class of 1. Oh, like you didn't play Dungeons & Dragons. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up later in the show, if you're about to buy an HD-DVD player, pause and rewind. But next, an executive trades his BlackBerry for a director's megaphone. We'll spare you the, but what I really want to do is direct joke. Still, as the saying goes, many a truth is told in jest. Yet it was no laughing matter when New Line Cinema tapped Kent Alterman, its executive VP of production and a man who had never directed a film in his life, to helm the new Will Ferrell sports comedy with heart, Semi-Pro. It's the story of Jackie Moon, the power forward, coach, and owner of the fictional Flint Tropics, set during the last gasp of the American Basketball Association.
The ABA will be merging with the NBA at the end of this season.
Yes! Yes! Oh, I'm so happy I can't even feel my arms!
Four teams will be absorbed into the NBA next year.
Wow!
Hey, Jackie, the Tropics won't be going...
Wait, what did you say?
No!
All right, you're being... Well, Jackie, don't bite yourself.
Kent Alterman had been the head of program development at Comedy Central, responsible for shows like Strangers with Candy, before moving into production at New Line Cinema. At New Line, he became executive vice president of production, overseeing movies like A History of Violence and Elf. But as we said, the $60 million Semi-Pro was his first directing job. Ever. Kent Alterman, welcome to The Business.
Thanks for having me.
So when did you decide you wanted to direct?
I think it was in kindergarten.
Yeah. No, I
always had been interested in it, but I was too scared to ever declare it publicly. And so this kind of evolved in an organic sort of way. And when I first started in television, I worked with Michael Moore for 2 years, and in a totally different kind of context, I was directing and producing pieces for his show, TV Nation. And it was something I was always interested in, but just had never quite declared I wanted to do it.
Uh-huh. How did you come out, so to speak, to your executive colleagues and say, I want to direct, I have an artistic bent?
Well, the background was my first project at New Line was Elf, and I was very involved with Jon Favreau, who directed it, and Will, and in sort of developing it and producing and sort of following it through. And I had actually met Will. He did a guest shot on Strangers with Candy. So I had met him back in New York, but didn't know him that well. But we really got to know each other well on Elf. And at one point, there was some talk about doing a sequel, and Will had expressed an interest in me being a director on that. And at the same time...
No, hold on a second.
Okay.
You know, can a star simply say, I have a good rapport with this guy, he gets my comedy, I think he should direct the movie, and
yeah,
you're off to the races?
That can happen, yeah.
Did you, like, have any film school experience? Had you ever been behind a camera?
No, I was completely ill-equipped to do this.
did you have any resume experience at all that would convince your bosses at New Line that they weren't getting someone who was woefully underprepared?
Well, I think everyone was probably a little startled, including me. But I guess, you know, everyone has a different sort of story to bring to being a first-time director. And mine was that I have a lot of production experience. So in television, like with those shows on Comedy Central, you know, I was basically the showrunner and worked really closely with the directors on every episode. And then when I started at New Line... you know, New Line sort of, depending on the project, affords you as an executive to be a more hands-on creative producer. And so, for example, on Elf, I worked really close with Jon Favreau and with Will. So it was really more, it wasn't like anyone decided, oh, we're going into production on this movie and Kent's going to direct it. It was more, hey, let's start developing this. And Will had expressed that interest in me.
Why did Will Ferrell want you if you hadn't had any experience directing before? How did the idea even come up?
I think that that's a question you'd have to ask him. You know, I can't really speak for him. I'm sure he'd be happy to come onto the show and explain that to you. But
but I mean, didn't you ask him?
Well, he has always been very kind and forthcoming about feeling a trust with me that he liked my ideas, you know, creatively and comedically. And, you know, we worked closely together before. And I think in this particular project, you know, I have a real history with the subject matter. So I could really draw on my own experience as far as developing the script and having a real vision for what the movie would look like and feel like and so on.
And we should point out that this is not, so to speak, standard operating procedure for a studio. New Line is kind of a special place. And there's a story that, I don't know if it's apocryphal or not, and okay. I'm thinking of the story of the former one-time intern turned eventually production president at New Line, Mike DeLuca. There's some story about Nightmare on Elm Street 4 or something where he just sort of basically, you know, he's working as an intern, finds this script and goes, oh, I can fix this ending. And then like, he does, and then the movie's in production, and it's being made, and it's just sort of this, you can't believe, it's as if the Pentagon were, like, leaving plans for the B-2 bomber around, and some, you know, intern or some rank private comes and goes, oh, why don't you fix the tail, and, you know,
yeah, but
I can build you that plane, you know?
No one got injured because of it in this case. But no, New Line has a real history of sort of taking good ideas from anywhere, and rewarding people and encouraging a sense of entrepreneurialism and creativity. You know, so Mike DeLuca, that's his story. And my boss was Toby Emmerich, and he was a writer, and he wrote and produced a project at New Line called Frequency. Frequency was an original idea of his that he, you know, wrote from as a spec and then became, you know, a great movie.
And we should point out The Last Mimsy, also directed by the CEO of the company.
Right.
So, yeah, there's sort of this tradition of people getting out of the office.
Yeah, I don't imagine that this scenario for me would have played out this way at any other studio.
So you make this decision to – you want to direct. But take me into the conversation with your bosses. Like, when does this happen that they say, okay, Kent?
Well, it sort of was a very gradual thing because it first was expressed, you know, in this ELF conversation. And
this is like 4 years ago.
Yeah, quite a while back. And I think Toby's first reaction was, oh, that doesn't suit my agenda because I'd rather have you over. I'd rather have you overseeing a bunch of projects than getting consumed by one, which was flattering to me. And I appreciated him being, you know, so honest with me. And at the same time, in the next breath, he was very supportive and said, if it's something you're interested in, I'll back you on it. And there was, you know, that was sort of like set the tone for the company in general to be very supportive, that if it was something that I wanted to pursue. And I had to think about it for myself also.
Was there any point where, you know, you go to work every day at New Line, you're making a good living, you're a senior VP or whatever your title is. That's a good life in Hollywood, you know? I mean, I imagine you can live comfortably and live securely. You've got a wife, you got a kid on the way. Did you ever think like, God, I'm like kind of taking a huge risk here?
Of course. I think I would be an idiot not to think about that. But, you know,
were you scared at all? Or?
At times. But, you know, I've had a history of doing that. My background was in photography and design. And I started out working in New York in graphic design and was making, at that time, a really comfortable living. And they were interested in me being a partner in this big firm. But I thought, no, I'm more interested in developing and creating stuff. And so I unplugged and just got together with writer friends of mine and started developing projects and pitching projects around town. And ultimately, you know, I got that job with Michael Moore on TV Nation, and that was freelance. And then I spent 2 years on that. So I kind of took risks along the way, unplugging from secure jobs to try something else. And it's so far, it's always paid off. So I kind of used that, my own personal history, as some sort of sense of confidence to drive me through it. And, you know, I guess it remains to be seen whether it was a smart move or a dumb move. And
what was the conversation with the wife like?
She was totally against it. No, I'm just kidding. She was incredibly supportive and really helped me get through the process. And, you know, it kind of went into a dormancy because Scott Armstrong, who had done a lot of writing on ELF, he had pitched the idea to us, to Cale Boyder and myself, who's a colleague at New Line, about doing a comedy about the old ABA. And for me, it was all I needed to hear because I grew up in San Antonio as a kid when the Spurs came into existence. And I have a lot of history with being an obnoxious kid in San Antonio and being a real fixture at the Spurs games.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Kent Alterman, the semi-pro director of Semi-Pro. While he'd never directed a film before, as a suit, he'd overseen dozens of TV shows and feature films. Share with me one of those experiences. What are some of your like favorite ABA?
Well, just in brief, when they brought the Spurs to San Antonio, they tried to make it a very community-based enterprise. I think really just to sort of drum up interest in the community. And so there were three main investors in town, but they opened it up for people to invest, almost the way the Green Bay Packers are owned by the community. And my father, my uncle, and a friend of theirs went in together, and they bought one share of the team. So we were considered owners. So we went to all the games and sat on the third row at midcourt. And, you know, I was kind of a obnoxious, you know, smart-mouthed kid. And I was a big fanatic, I guess is the word they use, right, for sports. And I would always bug the PA announcer to let me shoot the three-point shot at halftime, which was a promotional thing they did. And it was a random drawing from the program number. And so I had a ritual where I would buy a program before every game. I would go write the number down on a little piece of paper and give it to the PA announcer and say, Pat, call this number for the three-point shot. And he would always look at me like I was out of my mind. You know, I can't do that. But I kind of wore him down during the course of a season. And towards the end of the season, he kind of looked at me in the second quarter when it was time for the random drawing, and he called my number, and I went out and sank the shot, by the way. And I won a gift certificate to a men's store in San Antonio and found nothing of interest, so I gave it to my dad.
You can get yourself some braces or
right, or a tie.
Or a pork pie hat or
yeah.
something.
And so we started to develop this project, but it didn't get very far because everyone was busy on other projects. And then a couple of years ago, Scott sort of cleared his desk and said, oh, why don't we get back into that semi-pro project? And I said, oh, that's a great idea. And I mentioned to Jimmy Miller, Will's manager, and who produced the movie, you know, we're going to start formulating that some more. And we had mentioned it to Will, and he really had sparked to it. And so Jimmy talked to Will, and Will was really still excited about it. So when we had about 60 pages done, we flew out to South Carolina to meet with Will when he was on the set of Talladega Nights. And Will read those pages, and we got together for breakfast, and he had great ideas and was very enthusiastic. So we went back and, you know, fleshed out the rest of the script, and Scott wrote a draft. We did a rewrite and then sent it. And then I think this all started because you asked me about my wife. I found out in April, 2 Aprils ago, that she was pregnant with our first child and only child so far. And on a Wednesday, and the next day I got a call from Jimmy Miller saying Will read the script and he loves it. He wants to do it next starting in January and he wants you to direct it. So everything kind of happened at once.
Kaboom.
Yeah.
What's the reaction from people in town, from your colleagues, from your friends? Is there jealousy? Is there politics? Is there joy? Are there gift baskets? What's the reaction?
To my face, everyone has been incredibly supportive. I can imagine there, you know, different people would have different reactions. But, you know, initially I think there was, you know, probably all kinds of mixed reactions, both at New Line and around town. And, but really, for the most part, I can say I felt incredible support from the sort of community in general all through it. For the last year and 3 months, I've been living in a cave, so I haven't really known what people are thinking or saying.
Had you ever spent $60 million before?
No, I've never spent that much on anything.
What's it like?
I tried to never think of it in those terms. Like,
would you have like seizing panic attacks if you really realize how much money is being spent by you?
I think if I indulged that thought, I would probably curl up in the fetal position, yeah, and just not come out.
So who did you report to at New Line while you're directing this movie, and how were you able to kind of maybe snow them using your insider knowledge of what film executives want to hear from directors, having been that?
Well, it was kind of a weird circumstance just because it was such a unique circumstance, but it really couldn't have gone smoother. You know, basically I dealt with Toby Emmerich and Kel Boyder, who were the executives on the project, and there actually was a real ease because we all had so much history with each other. I mean, everything I did at New Line was with Toby. And then with Kale, the first project we did together was Elf. And the second one was History of Violence. And so we had a great working relationship also. And
as
colleagues.
You were like in a completely different role, though. There's no friction. There's no...
No, it went really incredibly smoothly. Yeah, they were very supportive. I mean, they felt really good about every step of the way, too. You know, the script development and production and so on. So no big problems arose.
So there's a sort of a rich tradition in filmmaking where, especially for first-time rookie directors, the first day on the set to sort of prove you're badass, you have to fire somebody. You fire anybody?
I did fire Will. And I just felt like
that's a bold move.
Yeah, I thought it was the boldest move I could make. He just seemed like he was phoning it in, and I just really went after him. But we talked later, and we rehired him just a few seconds later.
Wow, that's intense.
No, I just sort of just jumped in and tried to do a good job.
In a moment, more with Kent Alterman, the New Line Cinema executive turned big-time director. You're listening to The Business from NPR. You're listening to The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. The critics were only semi-enthused about Will Ferrell's period sports comedy Semi-Pro, and people didn't flock to see it opening weekend. Or rather, many of them couldn't flock. One of the film's problems may have been its R rating, which kept Ferrell's teenage fans out of the theaters. We're talking to Kent Alterman, the director of Semi-Pro. He was a senior production executive at New Line before he did what everyone in Hollywood dreams of doing, directing. The R rating.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
That was probably the wisest choice we made ever.
You think?
No, I'm just kidding. you know, it was strictly a creative decision. We wanted this movie to have, you know, have a gritty reality. So we just thought to have a sense of authenticity. We wanted to be in locker rooms and be able to have cursing. And Will had never done a movie, you know, and I think he was excited about the idea of just, you know, having no limitations that way. And
how was the studio with that? I mean,
I think that no one would argue that the R was going to give us bigger box office. But I don't think it's the only thing that factored into it, probably. And
what else do you think?
I mean, at the risk of sounding defensive, because it could be that people just didn't respond to the movie, and I acknowledge that possibility. But I think that in a weird way, the movie, it felt to me like it sort of arrived prejudged. It was almost like a sort of referendum on Will Ferrell doing another sports comedy.
From Talladega Nights to the ice skating thing.
To Blades of Glory
Blades
to
of Glory.
This, yeah. And we were always aware of that, that that was a possibility. These were two movies that Will was interested that sort of just were coming together at the same time. And I don't think there was any great design that he was going to do a trilogy of sports movies. It just kind of happened that way. And I think that we naively thought, well, if the sensibility is different for this movie, that maybe people just sort of take it as it is. And maybe they will in the long run. It's hard to say.
Do you think you're viewed, now that New Line is sort of changed irrevocably, do you think you're viewed as a real director now? That is, not just some guy who worked at New Line who directed a New Line movie, but like by Hollywood, by the talent agencies that employ directors, by the other studios. You know, do you think you've made your bones, so to speak?
Well, I'm probably the last person to ask that. I mean, I know my mother saw the movie and she thought it was really good. As far as how people in town feel about it, it's, you would have to ask them on future episodes of The Business.
We got to leave it there. Kent Alterman is a former production executive at New Line Cinema who made the jump to director of the new movie Semi-Pro. Kent, thanks for being on The Business.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
No one in Hollywood really wanted to make the sequel to the early 80s disaster epic Format Wars, VHS versus Betamax. But in early 2006, Toshiba came out with its first HD DVD player. And 3 months later, Sony introduced a rival high-def format, Blu-ray. Negotiations aimed at creating a single format quickly fizzled, dooming both companies to repeat the Hatfield and McCoy routine. After years of behind-the-scenes maneuvering, the final shots of the high-def war were fired in January. Two fateful events occurred. Warner Home Entertainment, which puts out almost a fifth of all DVDs, went Blu-ray. Then Walmart, which sells maybe 40% of all DVDs, followed suit. Clearly defeated, on February 19th, Toshiba announced it would suspend the manufacture of HD DVD players. Elated by the headlines that the high-def war was over, consumers rushed into the streets, celebrating VHD Day. Well, actually, not only are people pretty much unaware that the war is over, they probably didn't know there was a war in the first place. Our Darby Maloney has more.
It's like the Blu-ray or blue disc or something is one, and then just the normal one, right?
Yeah, one is called Blu-ray and one's called HD DVD.
Yeah.
Did you know that last week the people that make HD DVD, the Toshiba company, decided to stop making them?
Oh, really? No.
You can't blame this woman outside of Blockbuster Video for not knowing more about high-def DVD, since both formats have made a kind of stealth entry into the market. There's been a high-def Blu-ray display in the TV section at Best Buy for years, but you have to look for it.
Blu-ray Disc will transform your living room into the home theater you never thought possible.
Oddly enough, there's still also an HD DVD display, even though Toshiba has been forced to abandon its format.
You're not getting the full HD TV experience until you get HD DVD.
While the high-def DVD war barely registered with consumers, it was a huge topic in Hollywood. When Toshiba dropped out of the race, no doubt there was a massive sigh of relief behind studio gates. DVD sales were down in 2007 for the first time ever, and some lay the blame on the HD war. Unsure which format would win, consumers just didn't buy anything, even regular DVDs. So now everyone is praying that high-def can finally give overall DVD sales a much-needed lift. Ted Sarandos is chief content officer for the DVD rental giant Netflix.
You know, this is a multi-billion-dollar move for the industry. And more importantly, it's a move that will preserve the lifespan of packaged media maybe for another 10 years.
Now, that may be a bit pie in the sky, but if anecdotal evidence is any indication, Blu-ray will certainly result in significant sales, at least at the outset. Siya Tajrishi, a supervisor at Best Buy, the nation's biggest electronics outlet, says the customers showed up with credit cards in hand within days of Blu-ray's coronation as the HD king.
I actually saw a lot more customers come into the store asking for Blu-ray players now, coming in determined that they want the Blu-ray player. We are actually sold out of our Blu-ray players right now.
While early adopters are buying up Blu-ray, it's hard to know if it'll catch on with the general public. A player goes for $399, and discs are $10 more than standard DVDs. And then you need a high-def TV for any of this to make sense. Ted Sarandos of Netflix.
The industry forecast for Blu-ray spending, consumer spending next year is $1 billion.
As opposed to regular DVD would be what?
About 35.
That's pretty significant.
Yeah.
Sarandos goes on to point out another obstacle to the future of high-definition DVDs.
DVD's pretty darn good.
Still, a boost to Blu-ray high-def DVD sales could come from what otherwise would be a threat to movie watching of all kinds, video games.
The PlayStation 3 also doubles as a Blu-ray player, which can play Blu-ray movies.
There are already 3.25 million PlayStation 3 units in U.S. households, and the studios see that as 3.25 million Blu-ray DVD players already in U.S. households. But what will retailers do with all their leftover HD DVD stuff? Well, the price of HD DVD players has plummeted. You could get one at Walmart for $79. And surprisingly, people are buying.
After they drop, there's actually a significant amount of customers coming in to buy them.
Because as Best Buy's Siya Tajrishi points out, people are using the now obsolete players as up converters to get a better picture from standard DVDs. Still, not everyone's going to go for that idea. So Circuit City, the nation's number two electronics retailer, has extended their normal 30-day return policy to 90 days for Toshiba HD DVD players. But Circuit City won't take HD DVD DVDs back. And Netflix Ted Sarando says,
After the end of the month, we'll no longer be carrying new titles in HD DVD. So if you've saved it for HD DVD, it will be fulfilled in standard definition.
Paramount has already stopped publishing movies in HD DVD. And at the end of this month, Universal will too. Warner says they'll keep making them through May. Sometime after that, unsold HD DVDs will be returned to the studios by retailers and destroyed. Which is kind of a good metaphor for the transient nature of the whole high-def fracas. Because with digital movie downloads coming sooner rather than later from the likes of Netflix, iTunes, and even your phone company, the idea of DVDs, high-def or otherwise, will seem old-fashioned before you know it. For The Business, I'm Darby Maloney.
And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.